We're going to kick things off by telling you that today is Moon Day. In case you did not know, Moon Day is today, commemorating the landing of Apollo 11 on the moon on this date in 1969. Three men left Earth's atmosphere and safely headed into the unknown. The Apollo missions helped astronomers understand our moon and the space around it. It also helped us launch large space telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope and the James Webb Space Telescope. Culture Shift's Tia Graham spoke with Ed Kackett, an associate professor of physics and astronomy at Wayne State University, about new photos from a brand new telescope, the possibility of alien life, and Moon Day.
Sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
So Moon Day, July 20th, commemorates the first lunar landing that took place in 1969 when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the surface of the moon for the first time 53 years ago. So each year we celebrate Moon Day in memory of that super cool and momentous occasion.
Talk a little bit about the building energy and excitement getting closer to Apollo 11, that launch, that landing. And, you know, there were previous missions before Apollo 11, but this one was the one that was pretty significant in 1969.
There are multiple reasons why people wanted to go to the moon. There was obviously political will to do so. From a scientist's point of view, there's lots of interesting things we've learned from going to the moon about its composition, about the types of rocks that are on the surface, about how the moon formed. And, of course, just the human desire to explore the unknown and inspire the next generation of scientists.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Throughout the 1960s, the space race between the Americans and the USSR was really building up, and the USSR was winning at every stage, basically, right? They had the first satellite. They had the first person into space. And so it was definitely a point of pride that the U.S. was really competing for this. And so, you know, the Apollo missions, remember, Apollo 11 was the one that landed on the moon, so there were a number of missions before that got the astronauts closer and closer to the landing on the moon, was really in the press everywhere. Public were absolutely enthralled by the idea of landing on the moon.
So you said three men went down to the moon, Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, and Michael Collins. What were some of those things? What were they doing?
So there was Neil Armstrong, of course, who's the person who first stepped on the moon. Also who went down to the moon with him was Buzz Aldrin, who also got to walk on the moon. And then, of course, they also had a lunar orbiter, which stayed orbiting around the moon while the lander went down to the surface. And Michael Collins was the commander of that module. And so he stayed in orbit around the moon while the other two went down to the surface.
Step off the land now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
What were some of the first samples they collected on that first trip in 1969? What did Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong do while they were walking on the surface of the moon?
Yes, so they had photography. So they had cameras. They were taking pictures. They planted a U.S. flag. They made some rock collections. They brought back moon rocks that could be studied on Earth for the first time. And, you know, they were actually only out there for a couple of hours.
Apollo Control, 98 hours, 5 minutes, ground elapsed time into the mission of Apollo 16. 3 minutes and 50 seconds to acquisition of signal as the two spacecraft come around the moon on the 13th lunar revolution.
And it was really in subsequent Apollo missions that they did many, many more explorations of the moon's surface. You know, they actually had, in some of the later missions, they had a rover they could drive around. They placed some experiments on the surface of the moon.
If you can, talk a little bit about the formation of the moon and the things that we found out after some of the missions collecting the data about our moon and some of the strange things about our moon.
There's only so much you can learn from taking pictures of the moon's surface and trying to figure out exactly how the moon formed, and understanding the composition of the rocks on the moon actually required gathering samples of rocks and samples of rocks from different locations on the moon's surface. So in the craters, in areas that they call seas. And from learning all this, we now have this idea that the moon formed in the early part of the solar system when the sun was very young. And we think that what happened was a large object actually collided with the Earth, and that impact caused the formation of the moon. And so the moon is something like, it's about a quarter of the size of the Earth, and it's the fifth largest moon in the solar system. And we think, you know, that this impact between a large object and the Earth ended up forming the moon for us.
And we think about all of that that went into the multiple Apollo missions and launches into space. How has that all helped launch telescopes like Hubble?
The Hubble Space Telescope was the first large optical ultraviolet space telescope to go up. It was launched in 1990 and really changed our view of the universe. I mean, many people are very, very familiar with some of the absolutely outstanding spectacular images that Hubble has produced in its 30-year lifetime. You know, it has a 2-meter mirror. When it first went up, there were actually some problems with some of the optical components of the telescope. One of the great things about Hubble was that it was designed to be serviced by the space shuttle.
And from the crew of Discovery, the STS-103 Hubble mission, we'd also like to wish everybody happy holidays and some peace on Earth.
And, you know, some of those first images that we received from the Hubble telescope from deep space, how far back has Hubble peered into the past?
Yeah, so the first images from Hubble were actually a little underwhelming. People, because they had this problem with the telescope optics, once they fixed it, they then had this extremely clear view of the universe. And I think one of the, several of the defining images of Hubble, I think number one is an image that's called the Pillars of Creation, nicknamed that. It's part of the Eagle Nebula. It's these big towers of gas where stars are getting formed. And then another one is known as the Hubble Deep Field. And this is where Hubble stared at an apparently blank part of the sky for days and days on end and just revealed that it was full of very, very distant galaxies. And that gave us, building on that deep field, we now actually have the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, which gives us some of the most distant galaxies that have ever been observed.
You know, how far back are we talking about? When you talk about is, you know, deep, deep field, how far back?
The universe is about 13.8 billion years old, and Hubble has been able to get pick up galaxies that are around about, the light was emitted around about 13 billion years ago. So within the first billion years of the universe, that's when the light from those galaxies were emitted, and it's then taken 13 billion years to reach us here on Earth.
The baby galaxy, we were looking at the baby galaxy.
We're really looking at the galaxies that are just forming. These are galaxies that are formed way before our solar system was formed. And they look quite different from galaxies that we see in our nearby neighborhood, relatively near to the Milky Way. These distant galaxies teach us about how galaxies formed and how galaxies have changed over time.
Hubble helped us usher in a new telescope that we're announcing and we're seeing for the first time, seeing images for the first time, JWST. Talk a little bit about the JWST telescope and some of the awesome things that we're going to find out.
JWST was launched on Christmas Day in 2021. It took about a month to get to where it's orbiting the Earth. It's in a very special place called the second Lagrangian point. And that's it's far away from Earth on purpose because it keeps it in a nice dark location, cold location for its instruments to work brilliantly. Hubble has a mirror that's about 2 meters in diameter, whereas JWST, its mirrors are 6.5 meters total across. It's significantly larger. It's so large, in fact, that they couldn't fit the telescope into the rocket without folding it up. So they actually had to, into the design of the telescope, figure out how they could fold it up and then unfold it once it was in space, to be able to have such a large mirrored telescope up there. So the first great thing about JWST is the size of its mirror. It's the collecting area. It's just a bigger light bucket to be able to get more light. That makes it more sensitive. The second thing is that it's designed specifically to look at infrared light. So we can't see infrared light with our own eyes, But infrared light is great for looking at very distant galaxies, and it's great for looking through dusty objects. So a lot of the stuff in our galaxy is actually blocked from view in visible light by dust. By being sensitive in infrared light, JWST opens our eyes to seeing what's behind that dust and learning about actually how stars form in our own galaxy.
And when we're talking about some of the dust and some of the things that we couldn't see through before, what did we see through some of those images that were released?
One of the five images that was released was of the Carina Nebula. This is a star-forming region in our own galaxy. And stars form out of regions that are dusty and lots of gas. So with the old HST images, a lot of what's going on is blocked by the dust. We couldn't see through it. By going further into the infrared light, we're able to actually peer through this dust and see the baby stars, the young stars that are just forming, where they're forming, and all the details of how that gas and dust is swirling around and moving around in this region where lots of stars are being formed.
And they usually are referred to these as star nurseries?
Yeah, they're absolutely stellar nurseries because, you know, one big cloud of gas and dust will end up forming thousands of stars.
One of the things that I'm very interested in is dark matter. I think most of anyone is interested in dark matter, dark energy. What do we expect?
One of the other first images that was released was an image of a beautiful galaxy cluster. And that galaxy cluster is in the relatively near to us, but it's so massive and has so much dark matter in it that it acts like what's known as a gravitational lens. So Einstein told us that objects with mass bend light. And by bending light, it works like a lens. And so what we're actually able to do is peer behind that galaxy cluster and see the light from the galaxies that are directly behind it. But those galaxies, because they pass through this lens, get bent. And so in this beautiful galaxy cluster image, you see these arcs and curves of the distant galaxies. So the exact arcing and curving, this lensing, tells us about the amount of mass that's in that galaxy. The images, we can see exactly what mass is due to the light, the stars in the galaxy. And then we can infer what mass is there in that galaxy cluster that's due to dark matter. And dark matter is just mass that's not emitting light but is acting gravitationally. And so we can better understand how much dark matter is there by studying galaxy clusters like this.
And I know you just explained it beautifully, but, you know, as we're looking at those images and the image that you're talking about, you do see that little bit of distortion right there in the middle of the photo. And so basically what you're saying is there's something that's very large right there.
Yeah, so not only is the galaxy cluster, there's basically a whole bunch of dark matter that is all the way through the galaxy cluster and beyond. And we know that mass has to be there, because we see its effects on bending the light of the galaxies in the background. So those arcs, that distortion that you're seeing is caused mostly by the dark matter that's in this galaxy cluster.
That's amazing. Wow. So amazing. So, you know, we're talking about finding out a little bit more about dark matter and how it affects things around it. What about the exoplanets and some of the things that the James Webb Space Telescope is going to find out about other planets outside of the solar system?
Over the last 20 years, astronomers have discovered exoplanets. So these are planets that are orbiting around stars in other solar systems, so not our own. And the great thing with the increased sensitivity of JWST is that you can start to look at the properties of some of those exoplanets in more detail. So one of the images that they released was of WASP-96b, and they actually showed us the spectrum of light that passed through that planet's atmosphere. So a spectrum is just the amount of light we see in different colors. And what happens is the light from the star that this planet is orbiting around passes through the atmosphere of the planet on its way to us. And that planet atmosphere absorbs some of that light, and we can see the signatures of that absorption. And what we see is that the light's being absorbed by water vapor, actually, right? So we know now that this planet around another star has a significant amount of water vapor there. And we can actually even tell by the signatures of this, water vapor looks like it could be clouds. So we get the idea that there is this cloudy region in this particular planet. This planet is nothing like anything in our own solar system, by the way. It's about half the mass of Jupiter, but it's extremely close to its own star. It takes only about 3.5 days to orbit. Its year is just 3.5 days.
Wow. 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 So, you know, my question is, how would it have atmosphere? Is that something that we're going to figure out eventually?
Yeah, so this is a gaseous planet like Jupiter, right? So all the star is basically atmosphere, right? It's basically gases. You know, when we look at Jupiter, Jupiter actually has cloud layers. And so this planet, too, it's very, very close to its star. It still has these sorts of cloud layers there. And, you know, it's close to its star. It's hot. It's about 1,000 degrees. And so that changes exactly how that atmosphere works. But it has an atmosphere. And we can tell that by looking at the details of this spectra. You know, as we look at more and more of these, we're going to get more and more details about the atmospheres of different exoplanets around different stars.
You know, just talking about planets outside, but what about inside of our solar system? What are some of the first targets that we're going to hit?
One of the things they actually looked at in commissioning, which is the first 6 months when they're just figuring out, are the instruments working? They looked at Jupiter. There's actually, in the commissioning report, there's actually some images of Jupiter already. So again, by looking in infrared light, you can actually study the details of the atmospheres of planets in our own system, in our own solar system, Jupiter, Neptune, Uranus. And get the most detailed information about those atmospheres than we've ever had before.
Everything that we're learning right now from the few photos that we've seen from JWST and the things that we're going to learn in the near future, will we find life, or will we find the components of life as we know it?
So will we find life anywhere else in the universe
yes.
with JWST?
Yes.
That's a tough question to ask. I think we just don't know how prevalent life is, right? The only life we know is the life here on Earth. What we do know from us, ourselves on Earth, is that we need liquid water, and we know that we produce CO2, and we know what the sort of signatures of life are, or life-like life is on Earth. And by looking at the atmospheres of exoplanets, we can try and search for similar signatures. Whether we'll be able to uniquely say, yes, this is definitively a signature of life on another planet, it's hard to say, but people will be absolutely trying to do so.
As an astronomer yourself, what are some of the things that you're really looking forward to with JWST?
One of the things that it was built to do was look for the first stars or signatures of the first stars and look at the most distant galaxies. And one thing that the astronomers have been most excited about looking at these first images from JWST is not these big, beautiful galaxies that you see and the nebulae that you see. It's that in every single image, when you look in the background, there's many, many hundreds of fuzzy red blobs. Those fuzzy red blobs are extremely distant galaxies, some of the furthest away galaxies that we know. And that is actually what most astronomers are getting particularly excited about, is being able to really study for the first time in great detail these extremely distant galaxies that were just forming in the early universe.
That was Ed Kackett, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Wayne State, talking with Tia Graham. Today's Moon Day. Congratulations. Happy Moon Day, everybody. Marking the first landing on the moon, 1969, on this date. And you're hearing it here on Culture Shift on 101.9 WDET.